also mine. I love it when I experience a diverse weekend, such as the recent one. I attended a large picnic in a park, where there also happened to be a cosplay event, enjoyed a relaxing hike on a beautiful day, and attended a game night, which included one of my favorite games, Telestrations. It is so much fun. I could have played just that one for a couple of hours. I'm always happy when I get to meet new people, which happened at each event. So it was a grand weekend for me. There are a plethora of ideas and concepts out there to attract happiness, such as the Law of Attraction and gratitude journals. Edwin Atterbury, the chief happiness officer at the nonprofit I Am Happy Project, experienced an epiphany in 2009 when asking strangers, "How happy are you on a scale from 1 to 10? Tell me about this United Nations web television that you were on. How did that come about?
It's a result of a group they actually sent out to my office, and they were doing a documentary on people having impact on the spread of happiness. And somehow they look it up on the website, and I got an email and say, "Hey, we want to come from LA, from the South, to visit you, and we want to just spend a day with the chief happiness officer." So it was a pleasure. And we just went around, going to different places in Davis. And they just followed me with the camera crew. It coincided with the celebration of the United Nations March 20th last year. So they actually flew in to do a presentation.
And March 20th is?
The International Day of Happiness.
Which is coming up.
Yeah, it's coming up in about 30 days. We are definitely excited about this one.
So when the UN web crew followed you around, how did you spend that day?
It wasn't actually a UN web crew. They sent an independent group. Okay, we just did stuff. I mean, I went to different places and showed them around Davis, which is where my office is located, and it's a beautiful place. We went to some of the artworks, and we visited the flea market, which is one of the very few. It's not indoor flea market, but it's roofed flea market in the country, and it's all year round. It's a beautiful place. We also visited the Bicycle Hall of Fame, which most people don't really know, but Davis is recognized for that. And I just showed them just what I do on a daily basis, you know.
So give me an example. When you enter the flea market,
yeah,
you just walk up to people and say... Yeah.
Well, most of them know me now as a chief happiness officer, so that was kind of helpful. And for those that have not known me, and I always like to seek those people out, the strangers, and I introduce myself. And right away, they see the pin, they read that back, "I am happy, wow, that is neat." Or they see the chief happiness officer, and they say, "Oh, that's the title I want to be," you know. One of the beautiful things about what I do is just being there. It's just more of the time, I don't really go out and say, "Oh, I want to be happy." It's just being natural now. It's just part of who I am.
Well, it's interesting. A friend of mine and I had a discussion in which she said that she would rather be content than happy. What would you say to that?
Well, I think contentment is part of it, but I don't think it's rather or. I think there is addition to contentment. And I don't know her or him, but I would think contentment means that you are satisfied with where you are. And that's a really good position to be. I think that's a really foundation for happiness. So it shouldn't be a rather kind of thing. I really believe that when you are content, you can add stuff to that. And this is where people kind of get confused. It's like, do you need to have a goal if you are content? Do you need to have a dream if you are content? If you are content, then you shouldn't just be need for anything. That part I differ, because I believe we are always growing. If not, we're going to be stagnant. And just because you are content doesn't mean you cannot seek more. It's just that your process of seeking more is not life or death. It's not, "Oh, if I don't get this, then I will not be happy." No, there is no contingency tied to it. It's like you're content right now. And if through effort and through different approaches, you get more, you're going to be content at that level. And if you get less, you're still going to be content at that level. It's just being a participating human being that is actively seeking ways to be better than where they are right now. So I think happiness is not the right at all. That's the only part I would differ. I think contentment is definitely a crucial foundation to happiness, because I really believe that lack of contentment can quickly cause unhappiness.
Now, did you have a happy childhood? Where did you grow up?
Yes, I was very fortunate. I grew up in Benin City in Nigeria. We didn't have too much in terms of financial stuff, but we live in an environment that there was so much love, so we didn't even know we were missing anything. It was later on that I didn't know that everybody lived like that. I just thought that's the way everybody lived, and it was cool by me. For the times that we visit outside of the area and we see what people have, it was just great. We enjoy it, and we come back to where we are. We are fine where we are. So for me, childhood was fun. It really was.
So what did you and your buddies do for fun?
Well, I play soccer.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Yes, that's something. Golly, I play soccer just round the clock. And that was another thing that was really funny, because growing up, because we didn't have much, we didn't able to purchase a soccer ball. So we make stuff into soccer ball. You can take a can of milk, for example, that you see on the road, and then you take that can of milk and you hit all the edges and make sure all the sharp edges are all muted out, and then you turn it to a soccer ball. And now you get a piece of tire, you know, the tube that is just removed from the tire, the tube. And you might get somebody that have some experience, and before you know it, we've turned a tire tube into a round ball, put some air in it, and you have a soccer ball. So you didn't really need to have a fancy soccer ball to enjoy soccer ball. And then, of course, we play barefooted because we didn't have shoes. So it was easy. I mean, you get two or three people together, soccer was going on. So it was fun. We had a blast.
Now, how did you get to the United States? Was it your family or just you? Or how old were
it
you
was
when
me.
You...
I went first to... to Amsterdam when I first left Nigeria.
Because
my brother was living in Amsterdam. I had an older brother.
What brought him there?
He was just visiting, and then he started doing business in Amsterdam.
But what is it about Amsterdam that got his attention? How did he hear about it? What was the pull?
I'm not very sure about that.
What? What?
Yeah. You know,
you
I
have
mean,
to
I was,
ask him. He is your brother.
Yeah, that's another thing. I think... being happy also means you don't ask too many questions. I don't know. But no, really, I don't remember. I'm sure that it was probably discussed at one time, but maybe it just didn't register in my mind.
So how old were you when you followed him over there?
See, no, I was going 17. Yeah, probably turning 18. Yeah. And then I went to schools, and I was kind of like a tourist that went to school on the side. Because I just love to travel. I didn't have much to travel with, but that did not stop me from traveling. I will go to a place, and the first thing I will find is a job. I don't need too much job, because I didn't need too much. I just want to be able to have transport, have enough money for public transportation that takes me to the next place I want to go. I think I later read about gypsy, but I wasn't a gypsy. No, I wouldn't go that far.
That because same kind of spirit.
The spirit was definitely there.
So from Amsterdam, where else did you go to?
I went to Belgium.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in Antwerp. And I actually was going to school in Antwerp.
How long?
Maybe I did a couple semesters. Then.
What classes did you take there?
I was always interested in aviation. Yeah, I wanted to be a pilot, which I later became. So I was always interested in courses that prepare me for that. And that's another thing that was fortunate for me. Even though I did a lot of travel and I attended a lot of different schools, for somehow these courses were lined up from the basic general classes of interest to more practical classes that went towards aviation. So that when I left Belgium to come to the U.S., I was able to go to a school that really was known for preparing people for aviation. So I got my bachelor's degree from Bridgewater State in Boston, near Boston. It's in Bridgewater State. It's now Bridgewater University in Massachusetts. And I still don't really understand how this happened. But somehow I landed in Eldorado Aeronautical University for my MBA. And the reason I said I don't know quite where, maybe I do a little bit, but because it was so expensive and I didn't have money. So the dean of aviation said, "You want to pursue aviation? This is the school you should go." He wrote a letter to them, me crossing my finger, and I got accepted. Now it's, how do you get the money? Because the kind of job I was doing was never going to add up. Not the security guard was paying me $2.75 an hour, or working in a nursing home and was getting $4 an hour, or cleaning places in a restaurant or club. That was not going to cut it. But I was fortunate. There was instructors that were interested in my progress. And at that time also, I was serious about my progress. So they worked out some deal. I still remember this professor, and he said that, "You know what? I see how hard you are working, and I see the kind of job you're doing. And since you're not getting money from home to support you or any of those stuff, you are going to end up taking about 3 classes with me. So I'm going to recommend that you go take 2 of them from a community college, and I will approve it for you to transfer it back." So when I knew that was possible, then I had to go negotiate with some other instructor. So I do the hardcore, the core classes there, because they were just expensive. I do the core classes, but the general classes, the elective classes, you know, they would let me do it outside. That's, you know, how it kind of worked out. And that's one of the reasons I advise kids now, if you make up your mind to do something, don't look at the obstacle first. Look at the solution first. Because it's so easy to look at obstacle. Because it's right there. It's obvious. But the solution is not as obvious. So you have to dig a little bit more. Now, once you start looking for solution, then there's a miracle that takes place that gradually starts to reduce the obstacle and move to the point where the obstacle just vanish away. So that's been the story of my life.
And there's no happy endings, because there is no ending. It's just happy versus happy.
Yeah.
What happened in 2009?
Well, there was a lot in the media. The recession was hitting very hard. People that I've seen before that I know were very happy people, all of a sudden they're walking with their shoulder down. And some of them I just walked to and said, "What's going on? Have you lost your job?" And they say, "No." "What about your house?" They say, "No." "Are you still married?" They say, "Yeah." "So what's going on?" And some of them will say, "Well, they just lay off 40 people from my job last week. And a month before, they just lay off another 50 or 100. And I don't know when it's going to get to my turn. And at this point, I'm not really sure." So already they're just melting out even before they hear the announcement. And then there are those that obviously already lost their job. There's those that already lost their home. And so I just realized, wait a second. Yes, I know that all of these are important, but they are not as important as our health. I mean, we accumulated these things, and we can do it again if that is the goal. And to be honest, some of us don't even need some of these things. You know, but if that's the goal, we did it once, we can do it again. So that's when I started to meditate on what can I do. Because it's like every day you hear the news, it just get bigger. I mean, I think the media was having fun with us. They were having a field day. They were telling us it was going to get bad before it get worse. And they show all this. I never saw the Great Depression pictures as much as I saw during that period. You know, people lining up in their suit, in their jacket. I mean, that's when I really started to meditate. And I came out of meditation one day feeling really good. I write, yes, I think I got it. I'm not going to worry about the big global meltdown. I'm just going to focus on one person at a time.
What was the catalyst for the I Am Happy project? Was it a specific incident or just a general meditative kind of collection consciousness that you gathered?
Well, it was just responding to the economy at that time. It was a need for me to do something about it. It was having a role to play. It was giving back. It was being able to say, hey, wait a second, this is not the end of the world. This is a phase that's going to pass. And now we've seen, because for most people, it has passed. You know, some people are still struggling with it, but for most people, it has passed, at least compared to where it was back in those times. So recognizing that empowered me to say, hey, if I can help someone change their focus, because I've always believed whatever we focus on grow. And so if I can shift their focus on, instead of, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job, or I already lose my job, I'm afraid I'm not going to get another job, or it shift that focus, I realize somebody could be helped. Now, the biggest catalyst that really inspired the I Am Happy project was my encounter with the young man in Jack London Square in Oakland. And it was a beautiful Sunday. I was just whistling and having a good time, minding my business. And this young man came, you know, towards me, and I stopped him. For me, this was a routine conversation that I've done over 500 times before now. And so there was really no big deal to it. It was just, hey, can I ask you a quick question? And the way he responded shocked me. And I had to quickly decide, okay, wait a second, what do I do with this guy? And then I said, wait a second, what's going on, man? It's a really quick question. And he said, not really. I said, come on. And then he allowed me, you know, to ask a question, and then it's got very low at that time. There was just something about the experience that said, wait a second, you know, just share something with this guy. I didn't know what was going on at that time. It's just that the response was too much for me to just say, okay, let me go my way, you go your way. So, and then, can I share a story with you? And then he said, no. I said, yeah, we go again. And then he realized I wasn't going to let him go. So he said, go ahead, make it really quick. So I shared the first story. Now, towards the end of that story, I actually noticed him calming down a little bit. So I said, can I share one more story? And he did not say yes or no, which for me meant yes. So I shared second story, third story, fourth story, I think like seven stories, or no, nine stories later. I was relaxed, and then I reached out to shake his hand, and then he grabbed my hand, he wouldn't let go. And that's when he asked for my name. And I explained to him that as a general rule, I don't give my name. And that's why I never ask for your name, because in the very beginning, I made that decision. I did not want people thinking I was being friendly with them because I'm trying to get back to sell them something. I just wanted no string attached to it. So I put a smile on your face, you're a little bit happier, I'm a little bit happier, and I can go my way, you can go your way, and hopefully we'll meet again, if that was the way it's supposed to be. And he said, not this time. And he's still holding my hand. And he goes, I didn't want to talk to you at first. You've had me for like 30 minutes, which it was right. And the least you can do is give me your name. And that's when I said, sure. I gave him my name. He asked for the spelling. I spelled it for him. He released my hand. And I went my way. He went his way. And then the next day, he called me and said, do you remember me? I said, of course. And it was very distinct. I mean, it was just yesterday. And I said, yeah, I'm from Jack London Square. And he said, yeah. And I said, how are you? He said, oh, I just called to say thank you. I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm the one that's supposed to be thankful. What's going on here? You know, am I missing something? And that's when I stopped him, he was on his way to commit suicide. I said, but why were you in such a rush? And he said he just wanted to have it over with. So the first thing that came to my mind, you need to go see a counselor. And he said he's been seeing a counselor for 2 years before that time, and nothing was working. He just had it. So then I said, what happened? He said that with all the stories, crazy story I was sharing with him, it was hitting stuff that he knew was true. And so he realized, wait a second, I have stuff to be thankful for. I'm not a zero either. And so he went back home and started processing those thoughts. And he realized he went from zero when we met to 29 different stuff he was thankful for. And some of them were very basic, minor stuff, but they were real. So I said, what is now happening to you? He said, well, he said the pain was just so much that he suppressed all of that. So I said, okay, you're in a better mood now. You need to go see a different counselor.
I would say so, 2 years.
Yeah, and he said, well, he asked me if I'm a counselor. And I said, no. Just thank me and he hung up. So that's when everything changed.
Have you talked to him since then?
No. I don't even have a way to reach him or anything. Yeah. To me, I think he was more like just a spark to kind of shock my system, to say, hey, what you're doing, you need to go to the next level kind of stuff.
Yeah. He just needed his light bulb changed.
Exactly, yes, yeah.
And now, subsequent to that, you're actually helping children. So tell me about that.
Yeah.
Walk me through that.
We go to schools, middle schools, high schools, and we teach kids. And what we are finding out is, I would say, the last 5 years for sure, maybe even 10 years, there's a lot of body of science that's come up now to support happiness. So that happiness is just not this nebulous stuff that you can grab and everybody to his own kind of thing. That if somebody is really serious and they focus, they can improve their level of happiness with certain things that they do. That's what we go to the school to. We make it very clear, hey, your circumstance can be what it is, but you can still be happy. And it's not just pretend like nothing is happening. No, that's not going to work. We are humans. However, it's recognizing what is happening, and in spite of that, you can still choose to be happy. That's really where it becomes very powerful. And once kids recognize that, whoa, watch out. They realize they don't need to be in gang anymore. They don't need to be in cliques anymore. They don't need to bully anybody anymore. Because contrary to what a lot of people believe, the person doing the bully is just as much a victim as the person they are bullying. Now, granted, the person they are bullying is the one receiving the physical punishment or the deprivation and all of this stuff, but there is such a huge emptiness in the person that's bullying that for me, they are the same thing. And so how do you feel that vacuum? And the moment that a kid can feel that, I remember one of the schools we went to, and the kid came to me and he said, Mr. E, you know, I like them, they can call me E because their debris gets complicated. And Mr. E, I didn't even know I was bullying until I hear you talk. Now, what do you do to a kid like that? You know, it becomes like, okay, wow. And then explain, and then went about explaining why he does what he does. And from his own mind, it was very logical. It's just that the kid on the receiving side did not bargain for that. Okay. And so we had to say, okay, what you were doing is not really wrong, because otherwise that would contradict with his own logic. It's just that look at it from the point of view of the person receiving and that did not. If the person was your sibling, sure, maybe they might not even like it, but at least they know you're doing it with love. This person cannot interpret it that way. No way. So now that you know, what are you going to do? And it's, oh, I got to go to them. I got to explain to them. I really, you know, sincerely did not mean to do any harm. Now, of course, there are those hardcore bullies that knows what they are doing and do it anyway. And still, those people are still victim as much.
Usually originates from the home, something's going on.
Yeah.
And speaking of the home, have you received feedback from parents?
Yeah, we have. I mean, you know, I think one of the most dramatic feedback is a parent that called me one day and said, who are you? And I said, well, you call me. So what's going on? He said, no, I don't mean it like that. You were in my daughter's school, and then she came back and threw all a bunch of stuff in the living room. I said, Mom, I don't need this anymore. And I said, what's that she threw? He said, oh, it's all kind of gang paraphernalia that she used. And I said, I didn't even know she was in a gang. Until the daughter showed her how she comes out of the window every night at midnight and come back at 4 a.m. And sometimes when she's so sleepy and she say, oh, I had headache, or I this, or I that, but I don't need that. I'm happy. I don't need the gang anymore. And so she just got to say thank you that I saved her daughter's life, because she never knew until maybe one day she's called and say, oh, your daughter is in the hospital, or your daughter is in jail, or your daughter was shot and killed or something like that. And she said she would have screamed and said, no way my daughter would be belong to any gang.
Now, for the adults and my listeners, do you have any tips, an exercise or two maybe they could practice now to try to become more happy?
Yeah.
Consciously?
Absolutely. One of the things that I recommend, we actually do a lot of happiness exercises. One of the things I encourage people to do is just don't take themselves too serious. And we do that. Now, I differentiate it. I'm not saying don't take your work serious, because people who are paying you expect you to take it serious. Okay? Your employer expects you to take your work serious. Your customers expect you to take your business serious. But don't take yourself seriously. It's not worth it. Okay. You have to learn to laugh at yourself. And I do this all the time. And people say, are you crazy? And I say, I think a little insanity helps happiness.
true.
You know, and so you have to learn to laugh at yourself, and especially when you don't have to, or when you don't need to, or when you think you can't. That's when you need to laugh at yourself the most. And sometimes in the process, and I think biology is supporting that now too, because I was told that the brain cannot tell whether you are laughing for real or you are fake laughing. The brain cannot tell. If you laugh enough, it's going to secrete serotonin that causes you to feel good and be happy. And so I recommend to them to learn. And start it very light, because sometimes if you have not done something before and you go and all of a sudden do it, you might look like you're fooling yourself. So do it privately, and initially don't even look at the mirror. Just laugh. And then when you get to it and you really get it going, then I recommend looking at the mirror and see how silly you are. And it helps you laugh more, okay? So that would be the number one thing. In short, I have the 10 ways to be happy. And number two is learn to smile more and laugh at yourself. I believe that's very vital to it. It's something somebody can do at any time. It's something they can do that don't cost any money. It's something that they can do in response to anything, even some of the most serious things. You can go to the corner and just laugh. Maybe you can laugh enough until that laugh turns into tears, which is okay. And then when you are done, then you laugh some more.
I like what Ogden Nash wrote. The most exciting happiness is the happiness generated by forces beyond your control. You know, when you don't see it coming. By the way, Edwin has also created the for-profit The Happy Neighborhood Project. Check it out at happinessprototype.com. Do something different. Read a book written by a local author.